The Cold Omaha Podcast Network.
All right, quick, before we get going here, we do have a quick show that's going to be on tonight called Prep Football Preview. It's Luke Inman and Sam Ekstrom, where they look over the top matchups of the week in high school football. They interview players, coaches, and get ready for the upcoming playoffs, which are not that far away. It's at Buffalo Wild Wings in Lakeville. Make sure you tune in and check it out on coldomaha.com. All right, we're back here for another episode of Midwest Swing. You can find us on Twitter at Midwest Swing Pod. We are part of the Cold Omaha Podcast Network. Cold Omaha is on Twitter at Cold Omaha MN. You can also find Midwest Swing on iTunes, Libsyn. I always forget at this point, Tom. We got Tom Schreier running the dials and the knobs today. And Tom, where else can we be found again?
Yeah, iTunes, Libsyn, Google Play, Stitcher. Basically anywhere you can find a podcast.
Yep, so find us there. If you're hearing this, you found us some way or another, maybe on the website coldomaha.com, which we greatly appreciate. But find us any other way we can get you on our mobile devices and all that fun stuff, which would be great as well. We do have a very quick show, but a very fun show planned for you today, and I'm going to bring in the guest right now. We got Bob Harkins coming from the West Coast. Bob, how are we doing?
We're good. It's sunny and warm and not much to complain about other than traffic.
Yeah, no kidding. So Bob can be found on Twitter at BHARKS. Bob, lay down your credentials for the listeners so they know why we're talking to you today and what's going on in your neck of the woods.
Okay, yeah, I'm out here in Los Angeles. I'm a field producer for Charter Spectrum LA, which is the regional sports network covering the Dodgers. It's that channel that I don't know if your listeners know, but there's been a major struggle getting it on all the outlets. DirecTV doesn't have it, and everything. It's kind of been a big controversy, but yeah, it's the home of the Dodgers, the regional home of the Dodgers, and I've been with them all season, out at all the home games, and so I guess we're going to talk some Dodgers and kind of how this. Well, you tell me how this miracle of their season has happened, because it's. It's kind of remarkable when you look at it.
Yeah, absolutely. So we had a brief run as a podcast called The Warehouse where we chit-chatted about the Orioles. So we've got some experience here. People probably don't have any idea why we were talking Orioles, and that's probably a valid question. But we'll get right to it here talking Dodgers. First of all, I want to ask you, though, you did kind of tease it a little bit. How surprised are you that the Dodgers are in this position? I think that, you know, given how the Dodgers were constructed last year with Clayton Kershaw and Zach Greinke, I think people might have expected that team to be better constructed for a deep run into the postseason. But you know what? The postseason has a funny way of kind of changing and altering your plans, whether you run into a Mets team with Noah Syndergaard, Jacob deGrom, Matt Harvey last year, or the Cubs, or whoever you run into. The National League is a gauntlet. But despite not having Zach Greinke anymore, he's off in Arizona, it's been, you know, a better postseason run, I think you would say, for the Dodgers. What has gone into this season and getting them to the point where they are right now?
It's funny because I talked to just chit-chatting this season with a former Dodger who I won't name, but the guy's got a ring. So I'll give you that. But he just kind of shrugged his shoulders and put his palms up to the air like, I have no idea how they're doing this. Because it's not a traditionally constructed team, as you mentioned. They really have one ace, and then they've kind of put it together piece by piece. And I was looking at their roster, and they've had major contributions from guys like Brock Stewart, who started the season in single A and came up and made some key starts, or Andrew Tolles, who's kind of been getting a lot of mention during these national broadcasts about that he was bagging groceries last year. Actually, it was a bit exaggerated. He was like, he spent a week in the freezer department at a Kroger's, and he's like, this sucks, I'm out of here.
We've all been there.
But the point is that he was out of baseball a year ago. There was talk about he was in the Rays organization, and there was talk about attitude issues and things like that. But they brought him over, and he just shot up through the minor league system, and now he's on the playoff roster. Trace Thompson, which was a guy they landed, Clay Thompson's brother, the guy they landed in the, there was a three-team deal over the offseason, ended with Todd Frazier going to the White Sox, and the Dodgers landed Trace Thompson, and that he hit 13 home runs in the first half, and then he had a back injury, and he didn't play in the second half, but he was one of the guys carrying the offense early on when guys like Justin Turner and Adrian Gonzalez hadn't heated up yet. So it's really been that, you know, Andrew Friedman and Farhan Zaidi have talked about depth, organizational depth, and that's really what has happened here. They've used something like 45 guys this year.
You know,
speaking of
a back issue, Clayton Kershaw only gave the team 149 innings this year. What's amazing, too, is, yeah, no Greinke, no problem maybe, but no Greinke and no Kershaw for two whole months, and they still managed to patch together. Kenta Maeda has done a really nice job, but only one pitcher made 30 starts. Only two made even 25 starts. The other is Scott Kazmir, who's nowhere to be found in the postseason either. I think it is amazing, and you have to give praise to Friedman and Zaidi for how they've patched it together when, you know, they've gotten virtually nothing out of Brandon McCarthy, only a handful of starts out of Rich Hill. It's been quite a ride.
And the thing is, when Kershaw went down, I believe the Dodgers were 8 games behind the Giants, and when he came back, they were 5 games up and closing in on clinching the division. It's like, how did that happen? And it's interesting because I've seen some stuff with the bullpen. The bullpen has been huge for this team this year, and that's a lot of where the organizational depth has come in, because I don't think you get by if you work that bullpen, because of like what you're saying, like they didn't have Greinke, they didn't have Kershaw for a long stretch, and the other guys for the most part have not gone deep into games. And I've been thinking all year, okay, the bullpen is not going to be able to keep this up all year. But what they've done, they actually have worn out their bullpen, but they've brought in other guys. They wore out Adam Liberatore, and he ended up on the disabled list. They wore out Lewis Coleman. He took a long break in the middle of the season to get his energy back. And they may have worn out Joe Blanton. I mean, we'll see how the rest of this playoff goes. But then they keep bringing in other guys. You know, they brought up Brock Stewart. He ended up in the bullpen. Ross Stripling was a starter. He ended up in the bullpen. And we've seen they've kind of stacked their bullpen with guys that can go multiple innings. And then they just keep bringing in other guys as some guys wear out.
Now, they needed the Giants to be complicit for that stretch to happen as well. What did you see from the Giants in the second half? I think I know what everybody saw. I believe they had the worst winning percentage in the National League, or maybe I think it was like the second or third in baseball. I know the Twins were ahead of them because the Twins had an absolutely terrible second half, a terrible first half, terrible season. But what did you see? Again, the Dodgers did what they needed to do, but you know, since that's their big rivalry, what did you see from the Giants in the second half that really aided the Dodgers in moving on to the postseason?
Yeah, the Giants were a pretty remarkable story. You definitely don't. I mean, the Dodgers won 91 games, and the Giants, you know, had the best record in the first half and then the worst record in the second half. And I think what you saw there was their bullpen fell apart. While the Dodgers bullpen stayed strong all year, the Giants bullpen really cratered, and they, you know, I still don't know if they know who they want to close games. You know, the Giants were typical Giants most of the year. You know, they seems like Buster Posey and Brandon Crawford and Hunter Pence, those guys would always get hits whenever they needed a hit.
Denard Span, too, I think.
Denard Span, too, exactly. And they'd always get a big game out of Bumgarner when they needed a big game. But the difference was that their bullpen, Casillas just, he couldn't, I don't know what happened to him. Maybe age catching up to him. Mm-hmm. But it's funny, too, because you see, you know, once the Giants did beat the Mets in that wild card game, you could kind of feel all of Los Angeles's sphincters tighten up a little bit. Can we say that?
Yeah, I guess so.
Sorry.
We'll go for it.
You can feel it because everyone's like, oh, no, here come the Giants again.
Well, it's that even year magic. Everybody was buying into the even year magic for sure.
Yeah, and they played the Cubs tough. Dude, they were this close to forcing a game five against the Cubs.
Well, that game that went late into the night, well, game three, when they staved off the sweep with that late night win, I think that's when the tide started to turn a little bit. We had Matt Trueblood on here last week, and that was late Monday night into Tuesday. We record on Tuesdays, and I asked him about it, and he said, well, you know, he's still not too worried, but I have to say, you know, late in the game four, you know, that's when you really had to start worrying as a Cubs fan. And, you know, it was an amazing comeback and all that too, but you just got that feeling that no matter how much the Giants didn't look good in the second half, Madison Bumgarner and Johnny Cueto might have been enough to push them into the championship series against whoever it might have been. You know, now we know it's the Dodgers, but you know, those thoughts I had to enter the minds of not only Cubs fans but people watching nationwide.
Oh, for sure. But again, look what ended up ending it for the Giants. It was the bullpen.
Yeah,
and you know, with a nod to the great Cubs hitters.
Well, true. And what I didn't understand was why Sergio Romo didn't get in there right away. You know, it's funny. You look at the numbers of their relievers, and it's not like a bunch of guys with five ERAs. It's just you almost wonder from a distance, if you haven't watched each of those games, how they're losing. I mean, I think it's the same thing with Pedro Baez, who I know has drawn the ire of a lot of Dodgers fans. And then you look at his numbers, you're like, wow, you know, they're not that bad. But it's just guys who are constantly bad in big spots that stand out to people. And I think that's why, you know, despite fairly good numbers for Santiago Casilla, fairly good numbers for Sergio Romo, you know, the big spots that you blow up in, maybe don't kill your numbers with, you know, an earned run here or there. But if you blow games in that spot, it's magnified.
Yeah, that's true. And Casillas, like, I think he was good first half and then started to fall apart. So his numbers might not look
bad. Yeah, you could build up some equity with 40 good first half innings or 35 good first half innings.
Lopez was another guy, too. Lopez was not the same guy. He's been the loogie out of the pen. He just did not look like the same guy either.
And he's a free agent to be going on 40. So it's going to be interesting to see where he lands or if he continues to prolong his career, because there you're looking at a guy who I think has at least one ring, maybe two. You know, there'll be offers, lefty and a pulse, but it's a deal where it'll be interesting to see if he continues his career.
Yeah.
So let's hone in on tonight's game, Jake Arrieta versus Rich Hill. Hill has had a bit of an uneven postseason. I believe when I looked, it was 7 innings pitched in a couple outings against the Nationals. What did you see from Hill in that series against the Nationals? It looked like it was one okay outing, but it was very short, and then a little bit of a longer outing that wasn't as good.
Yeah, he has not looked consistent in the postseason. And he has also not been allowed much leash, and understandably so. The first outing was he went 4 1/3, and he did give up a home run. He started really well. He ended up striking out 7 in that, and that was what game was that? That was game two against the Nationals.
Mm-hmm.
But then he gave up a big home run to Lobaton, and then it kind of went downhill from there, and he was pulled. The second game, he struck out 6 in 2 2/3. Gave up a run, but he just was not sharp. He was not looking sharp, and Roberts went with the early hook there, taking him out in the third. And this guy, to me, is the key to the Dodgers in this series.
Kind of an X factor?
If you need the X factor. I mean, you know, the Dodgers management the last couple of years has been, you know, they've gotten their share of criticism for not going out and getting trade deadline, and this was their deal. They got Josh Reddick and Rich Hill from the A's, and they need Hill to be that guy behind Kershaw. Maeda is what he's going to be. You know, he's a smoke and mirrors guy. He's going to throw up a bunch of junk up there, and it's usually fairly effective, but he's not a 7-inning guy or anything like that. Hill has that potential to be that guy, and if that blister can hold up, maybe he can do it, but we'll see. He's an interesting story because he was in the independent leagues pitching for the Long Island Ducks.
Yeah, like 15, 16 months ago.
Yeah, yeah, and then
Yeah, didn't he? I think he started. Didn't he start their All-Star game or something like that? I think, or he was like an independent league All-Star, Atlantic League, I think it was, and it was a deal where they were saying, "Could you imagine a year from now, or a year ago, that they'd be saying this?" And it was just amazing to think about that.
It is, and he's 36. So it's not like he's like the young guy, like an Andrew Toles, who, you know, had issues as a youngster. This guy's been around a long time.
He's older than Joe Blanton.
Yeah, and he looked to be done, you know, but he ended up, you know, I think he was with the Red Sox. He ended up signing on with the Red Sox and looked good enough that the A's gave him a deal this past season, and then here he is. And if you remember, he had a start in early September in Miami against the Marlins, where he had a perfect game through seven, and Roberts pulled him, and he was not happy. He was at 89 pitches, and Roberts was worried about the blister issues that he's had, and he's like, "No, you're done. Sorry."
And they paid a not insignificant price, if we can double down on negatives, to get him and Reddick. You know, Reddick, I think, has his issues about facing lefties, which, you know, there's platoon guys in the league, whatever. Do you think that Hill has been a positive addition, given that he only gave them six starts in the regular season? Again, you know, it was at a time where they maybe needed the help. But, you know, with the sporadic starts based on the blister and all that, you know, has he been, in general, a positive addition to this team?
I just think they need more. Like, this is what they got him for right here, you know, to be that, to take Greinke's spot, essentially.
And now
in playoff games.
And now they're going to get Arrieta on the road. He's been a little bit worse on the road this year, like most Cubs pitchers, in fact. I think they've virtually all been better at Wrigley Field. He's been better. He was better early in the season. He really did falter down the stretch, at least. In fact, it mostly started in June when he started walking like four guys in every game. How do you view Arrieta as an opposing pitcher at this point? Because I don't think you have to look at him as much as the reigning Cy Young winner as you do, you know, a very good pitcher, but it's October and anything can happen.
Sure. Yeah, he's not Jake Arrieta of 2015. But that Jake Arrieta threw a no-hitter at Dodger Stadium. So
yeah.
I don't think the Dodgers are going in thinking, oh, yeah, we're going to light this guy up. But, the Cubs are better than the Dodgers across the board at pretty much every position, and starting pitching is certainly a big part of that. Not the Jake Arrieta of 2015, still a major threat. And a concern. The one thing I will say is that the Dodgers have been better against right-handed pitchers this year.
Mm-hmm.
As it's been well documented how terrible they've been against lefties. They've been much better against righties. You know, and part of that is, you know, Corey Seager, Adrian Gonzalez, left-handed hitters, and Justin Turner this year has been a reverse split guy where he's really struggled against lefties for some reason. Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Finish your thought, because I'm going to move ahead to game four.
No, I was just going to say Arrieta did face the Dodgers once this year at Dodger Stadium and threw seven shutout innings.
Yeah, so he's got some mojo at Chavez Ravine then.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, I did want to ask you about potential game four starter, I guess, Julio Urias. Not old enough to drink until next year, but put together a really nice season. What are your expectations for him in a big start like this? You know, it's been a pressure cooker to put a young player into like this, but it seems like he's responded at every stop, you know, with the exception of, I think early on, you know, there were some things where they didn't have him pitch too many innings. They didn't want him to get overexposed or maybe overused, but he seems to really have gotten into a groove. What have you seen from this young man, and what are you expecting from him moving forward?
What I've seen from this guy, so here's a guy, he just turned 20. His Twitter handle, I still think, says teenager in it.
Yeah, it does.
It's time to change the Twitter handle. But, yeah, just turned 20. He's going to be the youngest starter in a postseason game ever. This guy, you know, as far as results on the field, I don't really know what to expect. Like, it depends on his command. Basically, he's got incredible stuff. He throws 94, 95. He's got his changeup might be his best pitch. It's ridiculous. Good curveball. But if he commands it, he'll be tough. And to illustrate that, let's look back at his two starts against the Cubs this year. His second career start was at Wrigley, and he was not sharp, and he gave up three home runs, gave up six runs. His second start against the Cubs came in late August, and he allowed one run in six innings and struck out eight. So that's, you know, you could see anywhere in between of that. But I will say that he is not, the moment is not too big for Julio Urias. He is just, I've never seen a kid this young who just seems completely relaxed about the whole thing.
As far as young players are concerned, some of the biggest players on the Dodgers team are young players, whether it's Corey Seager, mm-hmm. Jock Peterson, Urias. This isn't the first rodeo for Peterson and Seager, who both saw postseason time last year, but how are the young Dodgers acclimating? You know, I think, you know, Adrian Gonzalez hit the big home run at Wrigley for the only run of the game in game two. And you know, you see some of the veterans. Justin Turner is, you know, he's got his moments where he's really, really solid. Chase Utley is kind of one of those grinder guys at this point in his career. But how have the young players acclimated as they get more and more used to postseason play for this Dodgers team?
Pretty well. I mean, I wrote about this for FanRag, who I think you write for the
yep, yep. Today's
knuckleball,
right? Yep.
One of the things one of the moves the Dodgers made in the offseason, and they kind of got mocked for it, was the re-signing of Chase Utley, who's 37 this year and isn't hitting anywhere near the way he used to hit. But the more I watched him play and the more I watched the clubhouse, I've been around that team the last 3 years, and I've seen a change in that clubhouse. And it's a lot of it has to do with, one, Utley's presence, and two, the sort of the emergence of Turner, because Turner has really grown into a role as a leader, and he's a very similar player to Utley, and they're both your classic play the game the right way, never stop grinding type guys, and they've set the example for these young guys. Utley's locker is right next to Corey Seager in the clubhouse. And Seager will not stop raving about Utley and the impact he's had on him from you know, defense to working pitchers to off the field stuff, whatever. He has had a huge impact on the young guys. And I think you've seen over the last couple of years the changing personnel in the clubhouse has made it a better situation for the young guys coming up. Guys like Ross Stripling and Trace Thompson and Andrew Tolles and Brock Stewart and most importantly, Corey Seager.
If there was a situation where numbers might lie, I think I might look at Clayton Kershaw's numbers from the division series. 5.84 ERA, yet was part of 3 1-run wins, you know, all three wins he was part of in the National Series. What was your takeaway from how he was used? Because I think, you know, in the game where he gave up 5 earned runs, which wrecked his ERA, so to speak, still 11 strikeouts, 2 walks, but he was allowed to work into trouble, and then, you know, inherited runs came around to bite him. Then he kind of got some retribution cleaning up for Kenley Jansen. I thought that the usage of him was pretty brilliant, but at the same time, I thought that maybe Dave Roberts got a little bit too much credit, because I think there was a lot of risk in not having Kershaw face Bryce Harper, and additionally, letting Jansen go over 50 pitches when he was clearly not locating. And, you know, with two on, you got to face arguably the best hitter in the National League, at least as from a pure hitter standpoint this year, in Daniel Murphy. You know, I didn't think that Roberts quite deserved all the praise he was getting. He still, you know, obviously went counterintuitive bringing in Jansen early and all that stuff. But I don't know. I thought Jansen was clearly gassed. I thought that they could have brought Kershaw in earlier. And the reason some people said was, well, you know, maybe Kershaw's on a limited count as far as how far he can go. And as a result, you got to kind of push Jansen a little further. But then there was nobody warming behind Kershaw. And that's where that argument falls flat for me, is if there was somebody warming behind Kershaw, I understand why Kershaw might have been a one or two or three batter guy he ended up facing. Let's see here. Two batters, and so you got Wilmer Defoe on that nasty curveball. I thought that Roberts unnecessarily let Jansen work into trouble there, but ultimately, you know, it was pretty good usage of Kershaw. What was your takeaway from Game 5?
Yeah, I think I pretty much agree with what you're saying there. I mean, to me, I know Kershaw got a lot of praise for that, and deservedly so, but that was his throw day, and he threw seven pitches. To me, Kenley Jansen was the hero of that game because he went 2 1/3, and that's a ridiculous workload for a guy used to going one inning at a time. And he got through. So, yeah, I definitely see what you're saying. It appeared to be a case of, okay, this is it. It's Kershaw's game, win or lose. And like you said, now no one warming up behind him. That's what they were going with. And, you know, it's game five, and here we go. So, yeah, I mean, I think most of the praise for Roberts out of that simply came from Orioles fans.
yeah, that's true.
The old don't lose a game without having your best guy pitch. I'm joking, but I do think there was a lot of level of praise coming because of the creativity used in not just saving this guy for that role and this guy for that role. You've got a win or go home game, and you throw your best guys out there. You know, you don't save this guy for a save or this guy for whatever. So yeah, I mean, I see what you're saying. I think the interesting uses of pitchers deserve some praise, but it was by no means a perfect situation.
A brief aside, what is your take on how Yasiel Puig has been handled this season for the Dodgers?
You mean sending him down to the minors?
Yeah, I mean sending him down. He's not really a starter right now, I don't think. I haven't been watching I guess I watch the games, but I don't really process how the roster is filtered through the lens of Dave Roberts when he, you know, writes a lineup or anything. So I haven't seen a ton of Yasiel Puig. I don't even think he has a hit this postseason.
He does not.
Yeah, so I mean, what is your take on his handling been? Because he clearly didn't play up to the level that he set for himself in this, you know, when he kind of set the league on fire to start. You know, where do you stand on him right now?
I think it was probably overdue. The sending him to the minors, mm-hmm. I think that was overdue. You know, whether or not Puig is going to be that guy in 2012 who played so well right off the bat and ended up being the guy who was on the billboards and, you know, the bobblehead guy and all that. You know, there's so much talent there, but what there hasn't been is a consistency outside of the games, consistency of work off the field. Guys I've talked to have said this, who are around the team, mm-hmm. have said this time and time again. You know, tons of talent, a good guy, a smart guy. I think a smarter guy than people give him credit for, but kind of a guy who, you know, was making 14, 42 million and doesn't necessarily know how to deal with it, make that transition. And he even said himself that when he was sent down to Oklahoma City, he was shocked because he was like used to 50,000 fans screaming when he'd come up to bat. And now he's going out to games and there's nobody there. And he talked about, I want to get back there, where all the fans are screaming my name.
Yeah.
So I thought it was no overdue to send him down. He's essentially, since he's been back, so while he was down, the Dodgers made the trade for Hill and Reddick. And so since he's been back, he's essentially been a platoon guy with Reddick in right field. And, you know, he's a top-notch defensive player. He always will be. But I think he's 0 for 10.
That sounds
in the
right.
Playoffs. He has not looked particularly good at the plate.
Well, but, facing Chapman, you know, cold doesn't help either.
No. and frankly, these bullpens in the playoffs have been ridiculous kind of all around. The Nationals have a great bullpen. So, you know, it's tough. It's tough. But, you know, at some point he's going to have to deliver on the field. And I don't know if it'll be in these playoffs, but I do think that they're finally coming around to maybe getting through to him on what he needs to do to stick around at this level.
So last thing I got for you, does your gut say that the Dodgers have enough pitching to get past the Cubs here and most likely face Cleveland in the World Series?
Now, my win this series, but they're just, you know, if you pick a category, the Cubs are a little bit better than the Dodgers, pretty much across the board. But this Dodger team will make a series out of it. I think they'll make a series out of it. I think it'll probably go six and maybe seven. But this Dodger team kind of defies logic a little bit in how they do things, but they keep doing it. And you know, here's an example. This season, there was the Cubs were out here in LA for a four game series in late August, and the Dodgers won three of those games. And every single one of those games was close. And the one game the Cubs won was, I don't know if you remember, Carlos Ruiz, it was his first action behind the plate after he was traded by the Phillies. Mm-hmm. And he was trying to catch Kenley Jansen's cutter, and he couldn't. And the Cubs rallied thanks to some wild pitches, pass balls, whatever. I think one was called a wild pitch and one was called a pass ball. But basically the result was that Carlos Ruiz had not caught Kenley Jansen, and he couldn't catch Kenley Jansen. And that was the game the Cubs won. So that series kind of showed me that this team is capable of hanging with the Cubs. But I think ultimately the Cubs probably pull it out.
Yeah, I think you could make that argument for the Indians too, though. They've been probably facing teams that are better than them on paper, and look at them up 3-0 in the postseason. But yeah, so we'll see. We got, you know, the game three, which is going to be pivotal, and game mm-hmm. four after that. Probably have a pretty good idea what's going on at that point.
Yeah, and one advantage the Dodgers have is that I don't think any of them own drones. So.
Oh man. Well, I do want to say thank you for joining us early this morning. I know it was awfully early, or at least would be if I was out there. 8:30 is early for me. So thanks for jumping on with us. You've been listening to Midwest Swing, part of the Cold Omaha Podcast Network.